I'd like to welcome you all to this session. We have two presentations, and I think that I'll just introduce them separately, and then at the end we'll have questions for each one. Our first guest is Samuel W. Taylor. Samuel W. Taylor was born in 1907, which must have been a pretty good year. My father was born in 1907 also. He was born in Provo, Utah, and grew up in Provo, Utah. And I sort of consider him a trendsetter. He attended Brigham Young University, and in his senior year, wrote an article about prohibition and got himself in trouble at BYU, but way back then. And then he was also a trendsetter in this way. He fell in love and followed a girl to California and settled in Redwood City, married and settled in Redwood City, and has lived here ever since. So he's practically an original resident of the Bay Area. Sam Taylor is a prolific writer. He has done a lot of Hollywood screenplay scripts. He did the book that The Absent-Minded Professor was written from. Somebody said, and now I know why, before I saw him, somebody said, he looks frail, but don't be deceived. He's peppy. let's see. And with that, I'd like to introduce Sam Taylor, and he's going to read one of his stories.
Well, thank you very much for that flattering.
There's one thing I forgot to say. He's the grandson of President John Taylor.
That's right.
Thank you.
And I believe I'm the only one here who has the distinction of being a member of the Utah State Prison chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous. How it happened, I was in Salt Lake for the Utah Writers Roundup, and I gave a paper, and the warden asked me to repeat the paper for the AA group in the prison. And as a result, they issued me a card as an honorary member. Now, the 176th AWOL oddball. It was a slow Monday afternoon at the Palo Alto Muni. Arthur and I signed in and went to the first tee. As we got ready, the loudspeaker said, "Taylor Twosome, please wait for another man." The new arrival was tall, well set up, gray at the temples. We shook hands, Tom, Arthur, Tom, Sam. Then I did a take. Frenchie, for crying out loud, long time no see. I'll be go to hell, Sam Taylor and white hair. I was almost twice your age when you were a G. I, back then, remember Dog Robber? He said, and Jesus, Barney, pretty boy, London town. I indicated Arthur. He was there in limey uniform. As we played nine holes, we traveled down memory lane. Nine was enough at our mature age. This is the coffee hole, Arthur said as we teed up at the ninth. Sam gives me a half stroke. I'll need a stroke from you, Frenchie. I'll play you even, Frenchie, I said. Couple of sandbaggers, but okay. I was stuck for the drinks. In the clubhouse, I got tea for Arthur, a Coke, hold the ice for myself. Frenchie said, just water, please. He was a Mormon and as strange a one as I've ever met. Frenchie was a goof-up of the 176th Ordnance Depot Company during basic training at Fort Lewis, Washington, during World War II. A fat, lazy goof-up. He was a rich kid, son of a U.S. senator, so he got away with it. Couldn't or wouldn't march, awkward squad. Mama sent him a fat monthly check. He paid another GI to make up his bunk, slick up the barracks for inspection, police the area, pull KP and stand guard duty for him. What it amounted to, this buck private lived like an officer with dog rubber doing his dirty work. Jesus Did I miss a page? Oh, yes, there we are. He certainly was popular with the rest of us. Instead of saying hello, we made loud sucking noises. A buck private can't just sit around on his fat keister, so the CO hid him in the supply room, which was manned by Sergeant Pete, Phil Watson, and myself. He was either snoozing, eating candy bars, or pegging out his daily love letter to Mama on the typewriter. He really had it made. Supply room personnel didn't have to do close order drill or pull KP. We did have to take our turn at guard duty, but Dog Robber did that for Frenchie. The GIs all had girly pinups above the bunks, except for Frenchie, Barney, Jesus, and Pretty Boy. Jesus was a Jesus freak. Dancing was of the devil. Movies were inspired by Satan. Having a beer was a mortal sin. When out on pass, Jesus would walk up and down before the movie houses, wrestling with the adversary's temptation. He always won. Barney, a devout Mormon, pinned up a picture of Church President Heber J. Grant. We call him Jesus because that's Hispanic for Jesus. His pinup was a picture of Christ. Frenchie's pinup queen was Mama, plump with a fur coat and jewels. We called him Frenchie because Mama was French. The senator had met her in Paris during the Great War, the war to end wars, when Dad was a staff sergeant. Frenchie was an only child. Mama wanted a girl to play dolls with. Dad wanted a boy to grow up and fight for his country. It was a boy, but Mama gave him a French name, Marie. Dad called him by his middle name, Tom. In France, they named boys Marie, but not here. He went by his middle name, except that in the army, it was Marie in the records. So we called him Frenchie or else. And a funny thing about Frenchie, he admitted that he had never kissed a girl except Mama. All kinds of characters were in the company. A newspaper man from San Jose, a Hollywood film hustler, a funeral director from Chicago, a South Seas native, and there was Pretty Boy. He didn't have a pin-up queen above his bunk because he carried his own, a good-sized mirror. Pretty Boy spent his spare time admiring his reflection. We didn't think it was, he was all that handsome, but he had another opinion. Except for these, the company was primarily composed of youngsters from average families. In England, we landed at a camp of dispersed knitting huts at Burton-upon-Trent near Gloucester, which the Limeys call Gloucester. We lined up next morning, and Captain Thompson said, "Now, men, we're on foreign soil. The Limeys speak English, but they don't talk American. They don't think American. They don't eat American. They even drive on the wrong side of the road. But the important thing I've got to tell you, watch out for the Limey girls. They've been fed on Hollywood movies, big cars, lots of money, sunshine, married happy ever in Beverly Hills. Then there's the climate on this tight little isle. Just two kinds of weather. Clammy cold and really foul. Summer comes here on Wednesday, then on Thursday it's autumn. The Limey girls are crazy to marry Yank and get out of the fog. So I'm warning you, men, watch out they don't trip you and fall underneath. Pretty soon, the GIs began getting a week's furlough in London. When it was Frenchie's turn, he took French leave, AWOL, absent without leave. That was serious business in the European theater of war, the war zone. About a month later, I had my week in London. We had been told to locate an air raid shelter close to the hotel. I went into the Bond Street underground station where people were settling for the night on the boarding platforms with sleeping bags, blankets, and mattresses. But no soldiers were there. In fact, no young people. Here were the old, the lame, the halt, and the blind, treasuring what little time they had left. Young people with everything to live for stayed above ground. My two-shilling room was on the top floor of the Red Cross Hotel. As I realized all too well when the air raid sirens woke me up in the night. From the window I saw circle flares floating in the black sky, searchlights probing for Jerry's ACAC bursting like 4th of July fireworks. Bombs grunted as they flung great sheets of fire. Well, I hopped into my uniform, put on my steel helmet, and burst out the door, only to stop suddenly at sight of a pretty British lass sitting there in a tin hat beside a bucket of water and an oil lantern. "What the hell are you doing there? Fire watching, Yank." "Well, if you can fire watch, I can watch the blitz." I climbed out the window onto the tile roof of the adjoining building for a ringside seat. The drone of Jerry's engines above the circle flare, the quick double concussion of the ACAC, and the snarling roar of rockets. A bomb burst nearby, a great grunt rattling the roof tiles and windows. I looked up towards the unseen drone of Jerry's engines and spoke aloud, "Jerry, you silly fool, don't you know you'll never lick England?" On my last night there, I was walking along Oxford Street near Marble Arch, and after the pubs closed, when a figure slipped out of a doorway, sort of grunted, and handed me a card. I snapped on my cigarette lighter to read the blackout. "Death, please spare a dime." The guy wore beat-up pants, a ragged overcoat. He looked like death warmed over. As I slipped him half a crown, we looked at each other. A week's whiskers, needed a haircut, but Frenchie, what the hell? Slam, don't give me away, for Christ's sake. "Listen, you chump, you can't expect to get away with this." "I've got to dummy up. I can't talk limey. If I open my face, they'll know I'm an AWOL GI. What about afterwards, when the war's over? You'll never be able to go home." "Yes, I know, Sam. I know only too damn well. But AWOL for 2 months, that's desertion. They'd throw the book at me. And Dad couldn't help me, nor Mama." "No, they couldn't, and your dad wouldn't if he could. You know why?" "Damned right I know why. Mama begged him to get me deferred with a soft job in defense industry. Wouldn't do it. She wanted him to see I got a commission, an officer and a gentleman. No. He let me get drafted a bucktail private in this stinking army. That's why. No, that's not why, Frenchie. The reason he let you be drafted like the rest of us was because he wanted the army to make a man out of mama's boy. That's why. Don't give me that horseradish. Okay, but that's what your dad told me. Told you? What the hell do you mean, Dad told you? A congressional delegation flew over to England a week after you went AWOL. Your dad visited our outfit, and the CO brought him into the supply room where you worked. He asked me about you, and of course I said you were a great guy and a good soldier. Then he said to the CO that he understood you were a private, and Captain Thompson said, why, yes, but I'll put him in for PFC as soon as you get back from furlough. And the senator said, I'm certainly glad. You're not showing him any special favors on my account, Captain. And I'm glad the Army is making a real man out of him. When Frenchie heard this, it hit him hard. He realized for the very first time that his old man really wanted to be proud of him, that the senator had pull strings to get him into Captain Thompson's outfit for the very reason he didn't want Frenchie to get special treatment as a senator's son. Frenchie said, Sam, I did intend to go back to the outfit when I was only a week AWOL. Except I met up with Dog Robber. So I kissed Trixie goodbye. Trixie? Well, Sam, she was my first girl, and I've got to admit I've been a plain damn fool by the numbers. He had met Trixie his first night in London. Hello, soldier. Looking for a good time? A Piccadilly commando, a hooker in the twilight of her career, getting long the tooth for that business, plump, mature, motherly, a fur coat and fake jewels. Wow. Give me a girl just like the girl who married your old dad. Frenchie fell for her like a ton of bricks. Sure, he knew she was a hooker, but he swallowed her pitiful story of being forced into a life of sin because she was the sole support of her widowed sister, Libby, who lived in Tooting and had 9 kids, all under 12, and was unable to work because of a bum ticker. So Frenchie felt noble in reclaiming the victim of cruel circumstance. He shelled out for poor Libby and her urchins. When he was a week AWOL and almost broke, he kissed Trixie goodbye until he got another furlough, and went to Paddington Station to take a train back to the outfit. He figured Captain Thompson would cover up for being AWOL. He met Dog Rubber there, who had been on London leave. On a chance of meeting up with Frenchie, he had brought the mail. One letter had a check from Mama. A package from her contained three pairs of nylons. Oh boy, nylons! Mama had sent them because he had written that he had a girlfriend, and that at that time one pair would melt any girl's flinty heart. So he told Dog Rubber to report to Captain. He'd be back for sure next day. Why wait another day, Frenchie, I asked. With a check for Mama and three pair of nylons? Don't be silly, Sam. Figured to have a big surprise for her when she got back from tooting. I'd find a nice apartment for her, give her the nylons and some money for Libby, and we'd make plans to get married. He spent several hours looking for a place and find a nice apartment at Queen's Gardens in the West End. He then went over to Petticoat Lane Market, or he could buy stuff without coupons, and found a nice silk dress right off of Rich Lloyd's back, Yank. And a pair of high heel slippers right off her feet for Trixie. That afternoon, he was among thousands of people who forgot the war for several hours. The bus was crowded. No room inside, the lady ticket taker had been saying at each stop. Inside was the lower floor of the double-deck bus en route to Kew Gardens. At Victoria Gate, almost everyone got off. Don't stay too late, she cautioned, or you'll queue up for hours getting back. Frenchie went through the turnstile and was out of the war into a fairyland. Here he strolled among paths with a lovely surprise at every turn. Rhododendrons made stunning mass effects. Acres of bulbs and wildflowers bloomed among the trees, a total of about a square mile of lawn. Was groomed to perfection. The rock garden was a world in itself, in a valley edged with shrubs and conifers. The rose trellis was several hundred yards long. Hundreds of little gardens were spotted here and there in the lawns. The hothouse was a large place, the magnificent setting. The lake before it having swans and wild ducks swimming about. Overhead a thousand plane mission of American bombers droned toward Germany. They made Kew Gardens seem more than ever an island of peace in a world of war. The war was but a moment in centuries of British history. London had retained a perspective of human values. Whatever the cost of maintaining Kew Gardens, It was a bargain. Frenchie spent more time there than he had figured in the land of enchantment. When he had headed for Victoria Gate, there were hundreds of people queued up for the bus and tube. It was dark when he arrived at Trixie's flat with the surprises for her. He let himself in with his latch key, saw a light under her bedroom door indicating that she was back from tooting. He opened the door and Trixie gasped. She was in bed with a GI. His jacket on the back of the chair identified him as an Air Force buck sergeant. "Okay, Mac," the GI said, looking around. "Why don't you wait your turn?" Frenchie gaped. For the very first time, he knew what Trixie was. She had played him for a sucker. She was just an overripe hooker, getting long in the tooth, would take him for his role. "Larry!" Trixie screamed. "Larry! Larry!" Her pimp and two plug uglies barged in and began beating the hell out of Frenchie. "Can't you do that, son?" "In the other room," the GI asked. "I paid good money for this piece." When he came to, Frenchie was bruised and bloody, lying in a black back alley. All he had on was his shoes and underwear. They'd stripped him of his uniform and even his dog tags. He was in one hell of a fix. A young guy who couldn't talk limey, flat broke, no clothing. That night, he copped an old pair of work pants from a clothesline and found a patched shirt on another line. A couple of days later, he found a ragged overcoat discarded in a trash can. But he didn't eat a bite for 6 days, couldn't even panhandle because of his accent. The talk would expose himself as an American deserter. He dreamed up the dummy act and managed to get by. An MP came along. Frenchie turned his back. The MP shot his flashlight on me. "Your pass, Corporal?" I gave it to him. "A week in old London town, eh, Mac?" "Yep, and back to the salt mine tomorrow, Mac." "How's it been, Mac?" "A-okay, Mac." He walked on. I said, "Tell you what, Frenchie, I'll be at Paddington Station at 7 tomorrow morning. If you're there, I'll stand you for fish and chips and train fare to Burton-upon-Trent." He shook his head. "No go, Sam. They'd throw the book at me." "Sure they would. But there's still a chance." I told him about the program they had for goof-ups in the Army. The Army Disciplinary Training Center. "Yes, it's tough, it's grim, it takes guts and a real man to cut the mustard, and it's 6 months of hell, but I'll tell you one thing, you won't come out of it a mama's boy." "Your old man will be proud of you, and mama also." "Sorry, I can't do it, Sam. Just can't. Thanks for the half crown. if they're not turning me into an MP. I took out my billfold. It held 3 one-pound notes. I gave him 2, then said goodbye and good luck. When I arrived at Paddington Station next morning, he was there. He'd shaved and bathed, looked some better. Couldn't pass up those fish and chips, he said. Here's the 2 pounds I owe you. I still owe a half crown. When he showed up at the outfit, they threw the book at him. General court-martial, 20 years at hard labor. But he took the last chance. The disciplinary training center. Discipline. 6 hours of close order drill every morning. Generally a 12-mile hike with a full field pack. Hut, hoot, heat, whore. Tough drill sergeants. No soldiering. Then in the afternoon, 6 more hours of hard work, building army camps, making roads, unloading freight cars, whatever. No shortage of work. No passes, no furloughs, no day room, no mail, no nothing. At night in a compound, having a high fence stopped by barbed wire, the guard tires at the corners, grind, 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 discipline, 6 months of it. When he reported to Captain Thompson at Burton-upon-Trent, he was ready for a fresh start. His past record had been scrubbed clean. As we sat in the clubhouse of the Palo Alto Muni, nursing our respective water, tea, and coke, holy ice, I said, Frenchie, you remember I transferred to the Air Force shortly after you got back. Yeah, I can't say I blame you. The 176 with chicken. What I wanted to do was fight the war with my own weapon, a typewriter. I became an Air Force correspondent. But how about you? How'd you come out with the captain? I was only in the 176 long enough for the paperwork to go through channels. Then I was assigned to an infantry outfit. My record had been scrubbed clean, and I wasn't required to try to live down my past in the old company. In the new outfit, I made staff sergeant. By the time we hit the beach at Normandy on D-Day, did you ever happen to run into my nephew, Keith Taylor? He was in command of an assault vessel on D-Day. Small world. Keith Taylor was CO of the boat I was on. Small world. How is he? Dead, I'm afraid. Frenchie rose. Well, I've got a meeting tonight in the city. He shook hands and was gone. Arthur asked, what was Frenchie's last name? His AWOL record had been erased, so I said, don't think he mentioned that. No, he didn't. And what does he do? He's the governor of a state. There's governor's convention starting tonight in the city. Yes, I saw that in the Chronicle. What state is he governor of? Don't think he mentioned it.
Hello,
suggest any remarks to Sam Taylor? Okay, let's go on to our next presentation. Our next presentation is Karen Rosenbaum, and Karen and I share a love for a man. Claude doesn't even mind. Karen and I share a love for Wallace Stegner, and she's written a paper, in the program, I think it's called The Unwritten Letter to Wallace Stegner. Karen was born up in northeastern California in a ghost town now, a place called Walker Mine. Her father was a metallurgical engineer, and so she moved around to places like that when she was young. She lived, after they moved from Walker Mine, she lived in southern Nevada and then in Salt Lake. She was educated at the University of Utah and Stanford. For the last 28 years, she has taught English at Ohlone College, and she says of this time that it's wearing but not boring. And I think all teachers will agree that that's a pretty good definition of teaching. She writes for Sunstone. I'm sure that many of you have read her articles. She's written for Sunstone, for Dialogue, and for the Woman's Exponent. And also, she's written stories for an anthology, Mormon Stories. Her paper is a personal paper, so she'll be telling us more about herself in her paper. So now we'd like to introduce Karen Rosenbaum.
Is this on? Is that okay? Oh, should I just talk loudly?
Switch
on
the side of the mic.
Higher.
Oh. Now is it on? Okay, thank you. I remember well the first time I met Wallace Stegner because I wanted so much to prove him wrong. The place was the University of Utah, a room in Orson Spencer Hall. The year was probably 1960 or 1961. Someone in the faculty had invited Stegner, one of the U's better-known alumni, to talk informally with English majors and student writers. I qualified on both counts. Stegner appeared to me then the way he would always appear to me, handsome, erect, modest, and gently cynical. In response to a question I asked, he said he wasn't optimistic about the possibility of a Mormon bestseller. He shook his head. It takes too much explaining. He was an outsider who knew the lingo, but we couldn't expect other outsiders to understand. Like me, he had spent his adolescence and early adulthood in Salt Lake City, and he had great affection for the place, but I could tell that he was glad that Mormonism wasn't something he'd been saddled with. Something inside me bristled. A Mormon could write Mormon fiction for the New Yorker. I just knew it was possible. The spring of my senior year, I won a fellowship that would pay my way to any graduate school that would take me. In 1962, there were only two graduate schools of any real interest to a young writer, and I didn't want to go to Iowa. I sent Stanford my application and some short stories set in the places I knew best, southern Nevada and northern Utah. I waited nervously, impatiently. Finally, I got word that Stanford and Stegner had accepted me in the writing seminar and the MA program. The U's creative writing teacher, Brewster Gieslin, always skeptical of my abilities, bid me farewell with the advice to be a scholar, not a schoolgirl. I packed my typewriter, books, and clothes, rented a second-floor studio on Palo Alto's Cooper Street, and bought a 3-speed bicycle with saddle baskets. Stanford Library. I was one of two women and the youngest and shyest person there. Only the man speaking wasn't making eye appraisals of his companions. Balding and bespectacled, he stuttered slightly, and his jaw jutted up and forward when he spoke. Stegner was in Vienna with a Stanford abroad program. Richard Scowcroft would be our mentor for the fall quarter. I knew something about Richard Scowcroft, something the others at that table didn't know. Scowcroft, too, was from Utah, but he had been a Mormon. That knowledge made me nervous here, far away from home. At heart, a doubter, I was trying very hard to believe. At the U, I'd had several Jack Mormon teachers, but if they were interested in my religious belief, they never let on. But here, at a party at the Scowcroft's home, Scowcroft was squatting beside my patio chair. "You don't really practice Mormonism, do you?" he asked. I grunted. His jaw jutted forward and then dropped. "How can you do that?" I flushed, hunched over my knees, and made an intelligible noise. Sensing my vulnerability, Scowcroft was gentle in his criticisms of my stories. There had been a pause after he read my first story to the group, and then someone breathed out and said, "Hey, that's good," and others chimed in. During the discussion, no one but Scowcroft knew it was mine, and I think Scowcroft was as surprised as I at the praise. That was one bright spot in a difficult quarter. I had no facility for Old English, and I worried a lot about Albert Gerard's Wordsworth Seminar and the Cuban Missile Crisis and my new boyfriend, who seemed to me very old and very intense, and who, though he was disguised in the fluffy white garments of a returned missionary, had turned out to be a wolfish unbeliever. I welcomed the end of the term. Winter quarter Stegner appeared in our seminar room. Unlike Scowcroft, he announced who had written the piece before he read it aloud, so we concentrated on the story instead of asking ourselves, "Is this Michael's? Is this David's?" When he returned his story to me, there was often at least a full page of comments, typed, single-spaced. Only once was there a single paragraph. I had tried to write about my Seventh-day Adventist landlady and her wheelchair-bound and paralyzed husband. From my window, I had often watched her scooting him about on the back porch. I was convinced that he was dead and that she had somehow preserved him like a stuffed parrot. The story didn't work. "It's a young person's view of age. It's cooked up, not felt," Stegner wrote. I went back to writing stories about young persons. I had just turned 22. That quarter, I was troubled by Ivor Winter's Milton-bashing lyric poetry course and the rains that drenched me as I rode my bike down Palm Drive. But I had a new boyfriend, more intense and even older than the previous one, 27, but a genuine convert to the gospel. And I was almost comfortable in the seminar room and at the parties at the married writers' homes, where an absence of furniture meant that we sat on the floor. The host would buy a six-pack of ginger ale for me, and I would dutifully drink a couple, and then full of sugar water, which I wasn't accustomed to, would lean against the wall, listening in companionable silence. "Remember Captain Marvel," someone would say, and everyone but me would shout, "Yeah." "Did you send in two box tops for his decoder ring?" "Yeah." "Do you think we can call Stegner Wally?" someone asked. "How do you think he lost his finger?" asked someone else. We would read and wisely discuss his stories. "Field Guide to Western Birds is brilliant," said David Thorburn, the best critic among us. I preferred the boy stories, like going to town. The Stegners had a party, too, to honor Saul Bellow, who had been on campus and who had met with our seminar during the week. I was enchanted by the Stegners' wild green hill and their comfortable woodsy home. There were ample chairs and sofas and big china dinner plates to pile food on, and plenty of food. "Put a little coffee in that little girl's Coke," Stegner said as I balanced my drink on my plate. I nodded shyly at Saul Bellow. I hadn't yet read The Adventures of Augie March, which David had assured me was one of the greatest of all American novels. The others gathered around Bellow. I found a couch seat and tried to listen. Later, when it became evident that I wasn't going to burrow into the circle, Stegner brought Bellow over to talk with me. One day I set out for school as usual on my bicycle. Speeding down the side of a Palo Alto business street, I ran into a car door that suddenly opened. I straddled my bicycle, stunned as the driver and a group of passersby gathered round. "I think I'm all right," I said, and I put my hand up to my face. It was covered with blood. Someone locked my bike to a lamppost, and two policemen put me in the back seat of their car and drove me to the campus infirmary. The resident taped the slit under my lip. I'd missed my morning classes, but headed over to the creative writing seminar. I met Stegner on the library stairs. "What happened to you?" he said. By now my jaw had begun to swell, and I looked as if I had had my wisdom teeth yanked out. I cheerily explained that I was fine. "You are not fine," he said. Let's get you home." I protested, but finally agreed to call my boyfriend to retrieve me. By spring quarter, the more confident writers, Mort Grosser, Ed McClanahan, Bob Stone, had nervously started to address Stegner as Wally. I had no desire to imitate them. To me, he was and would always be Mr. Stegner. Besides the seminar, I took a regular lecture course from him that term, one in the American novel, and there I discovered Willa Cather's Death Comes for the Archbishop. I discovered some things about myself, too. I had enjoyed all those reading list books set in England or Boston or the Gothic South, but I, alone in my writing seminar, alone except for Wallace Stegner, was a Westerner. I had to write about the West, the Mormon West. It was what I knew, what I was. And perhaps it was because Stegner was there, my little Western stories were accepted, and I was accepted. One of our last class meetings, it may have been at his home because we were outside, Stegner read us something that he was working on. We listened carefully. I remember thinking it wasn't ready yet, and I felt honored that he would share with us something that was that unfinished. I think it was the same afternoon that we heard part of Bob Stone's novel, the one that would eventually be published as Hall of Mirrors, and Stegner wept a little at the power of the writing, and I wept a little at the power of the writing and at Stegner's weeping. Our last seminar began in our old seminar room in the library, but ended with Stegner announcing he would buy us all drinks at a place on University Avenue. In his car, he passed me and called out, "Want a ride?" Then it seemed to register to him that I was on my bicycle. We both chuckled. I don't remember much about the gathering other than it was rather dim in the bar, and there was a lot of wistful laughing, and I was drinking ginger ale. Stegner made us feel that we were one of the special groups he had worked with. Not all had been so rewarding as we were. We wanted to believe it. I would have some memorable correspondence with Wallace Stegner after I left Stanford and headed east. I was finishing up my master's thesis under his direction, a collection of northern Utah stories. A considerable dose, he would say, of my childhood, adolescent or young adult protagonist. He wrote pages of suggestions about The Mustard Seed, in which my young narrator almost drowned at a Mormon family reunion and didn't have a near-death experience. I have the sense, he wrote, that the narrator's experience of life is deliberately thin, that she is so young and unformed that she hasn't examined much yet. And that this thinness is supposed to have some relationship with the experience of death, which is also rather thin. My experience with life and death was rather thin. I had had some luck with elliptical writing. What I left out, I hoped, would somehow profoundly suggest to the reader all the maturity and wisdom I didn't yet have. I fooled a few people. I could never fool Stegner. I practically never say a thing like this to any student, he wrote, but I have the feeling that your story here is shorter than it ought to be. And again, pull aside the sheet that screens your characters so I see them, not their shadows. He added bits of gossip about our group and bewailed his lack of time. I hope, he closed one letter, you save a few minutes a day for silent contemplation. In my Manhattan apartment on my tinny portable, I typed and retyped my Western stories. Finally, both Stegner and I were satisfied. I retyped the whole collection after work hours on the electric typewriter in my office at Life magazine and sent them to him in a shirt box. The letter I got back was a kind of screech. "Karen," he wrote, "you didn't apply for the degree." "Apply for the degree? You mean," I thought, "Stanford didn't just know I wanted an MA? Why did they think I was there?" "But I've been cutting through the red tape," he continued. I don't know how he did it, but I got the degree only 3 months late. Every 2 years, Stegner published a book of short fiction culled from the seminars. He asked me if he could include my Logan Cemetery story, my own favorite of my pieces, the one I almost got right the first time. I was, of course, delighted. When the book was published, however, the story that appeared was the always troublesome near-drowning story, The Mustard Seed. I wouldn't be able to mail copies to all my relatives. Too many of them were present at that family reunion. And I hadn't even changed Great Uncle Moses' name. A few years later, I returned to the Bay Area and applied for a part-time position with the Oakland Adult School. To update my Stanford file, I wrote and asked Stegner to write a recommendation. I didn't ask myself how he would know about my teaching skills. A couple of weeks later, I got a postcard from Scandinavia. He sent in the recommendation. "That ought to do it," he said. A friend who worked in the Oakland Adult School told me that when the principal read my file, he said, there's a letter in here from God. I got the job. During the next years, I taught community college students, wrote short stories during the summers, and read most of Stegner's work, fiction and nonfiction. I heard his voice as I read The Big Rock Candy Mountain and Angle of Repose, my favorites of his novels. When I went to the public library to check out Angle of Repose, I looked for Angel of Repose because I'd misread the review, and the latter made more sense to me. Of the nonfiction, I devoured Mormon Country, The Gathering of Zion, which I used often to enliven church lessons, Wolf Willow. The only book I couldn't finish, and I wanted to, having just rafted down the Colorado River, was Beyond the 100th Meridian. I thought of writing to him in those years, but I kept putting it off. I had accomplished so little. I wanted to report that I had written more, published more, that I had sold those Mormon stories back east, down south, everywhere, that writing about Mormons and Mormondom hadn't confined me to the tiniest of critical audiences, those who understood the tradition and who, like me, saw the conflicts and ambiguities as universal. Like a child trying to please her father, I wanted Stegner to be proud of me. I guess I could have written him about my teaching, because I have tried to teach the way he taught, and I have felt good about that. But I could never write the letter that I longed to write. In 1987, Stegner came to Berkeley to read From Crossing to Safety at the Black Oak Bookstore. My husband and I arrived very early to assure ourselves of seats. I had seen pictures of Stegner in reviews on book jackets, and maybe I'd adjusted to any changes in his appearance, but he seemed to me to look just as he did in our library seminar room. During the question time, I thrust up my hand to ask about the conflicts of writing and teaching, something he had just referred to. He looked at me oddly, then responded. Afterwards, I held my copy of his book for 45 minutes while I waited in turn, my turn in the autograph line. Mr. Stegner, I stumbled. You probably don't remember me. I was in the writing seminar 25 years ago. I remember you, he said. You drowned. I laughed in surprise. I hadn't thought of the mustard seed for years. I cleared my throat. Do you use a computer yet? I asked. No, he said. I'm buying up all the used manual typewriter parts in the country. I saw him read a year or so later, and again he seemed unchanged to me. I knew, of course, that he must be aging, and had heard that he'd had a hip replaced. I even told myself that one day I would pick up the paper and read that he had died, and I sensed how sad it would make me. But I still wasn't prepared when I saw his picture on the front page of the San Francisco Examiner that I picked off the seat in a BART train. I was alone in the car, and I breathed, oh no, and I sat and read the article. I read and I wept, but not because an extraordinary human being and teacher had died. Even though his death was perhaps untimely, the result of a car accident in New Mexico, he had had 84 years of life, and in his fiction, essays, and history, he had pushed the West beyond its frontier fences. He had guided many younger writers toward their own important work. He had never wavered in his values. The earth and the human beings on it deserve dignity, respect, love. He honored the family, his own family, the family of writers he fathered, the bigger family of man and woman. In the hospital room in Santa Fe, his daughter-in-law told him, "You are the most moral man I know." And at least death came for him in the West. I am sad because I have been able to do so little as a Mormon and Western writer. I remember Stegner's initial prophecy that Mormon fiction would never have a general audience. Many years ago, in the second year of Dialogue's publication, Sam Taylor published an article called Peculiar People, Positive Thinkers. Part of his thesis to explain the paltry condition of Mormon fiction was, most good and great creative writing is basically the literature of protest. Remember that, Sam? And most Mormon creative writers weren't willing to put their protests into print. He, of course, was, and his very first novel was a bestseller, an achievement he plays down because, he says, any novel serialized in Collier's was automatically a bestseller. There have been other Mormon novels that have been quite widely recognized, but one of the reasons for their appeal has been the peculiarity, not the universality, of the people in their pages. The Mormon fiction writers I know are eager to put their protest into print, and some have achieved modest critical, if not financial, success. Ironically, the best-known contemporary Mormon fiction writer is much more orthodox than most of the lesser-known contemporary Mormon fiction writers. Perhaps Scott Card comes closest to meeting Stegner's criteria, a steady output of Mormon fiction with a strong appeal to people who critique books and people who buy books. Card has almost moved out of the American West into vast speculative worlds that magnify rather than dwarf Mormon themes. Perhaps other writers will be able to make Mormon characters and Mormon concerns meaningful to great numbers of non-Mormons. Perhaps some of them will be able to put the West, the modern Mormon West, into the American literary canon. But I felt, when I heard Wallace Stegner say those discouraging words more than 30 years ago, that they were meant as a challenge to me, and I know he wished me well in proving him wrong.
This has been such a delightful hour. I don't want it to end. We do have time for some questions. Yes.
I want to know if she married the second more intense older man.
No.
Karen, you need to have this stuff.
No.
Was this a younger man?
It was a long time in my past, long time ago.
Since you visited his home where he lived, and he wrote the book, although I think, was that
yes.
similar to what
yes, the two books that all the little live things and was it the Spectator? No.
Well, Spectator Bird was.
Let's see. There's kind of a sequel. They're the two all the little live things and
the sequel to Spectator Bird.
Okay. Well, those two. Do seem to me indeed to show his home. Sam would know this probably better than I. His hill and his home. That looked always to me.
That
seemed to me that way, yeah.
Well,
I read, maybe it was a Spectator verse, the one about the set in the Scandinavian country where the man had. It was an abnormal relationship. He was trying to father a group of children through his, I think, through his children. I don't remember. It was an abnormal relationship. And I read Angler's Repose, which I have to admit I didn't finish. I was also struck in the first part of that book, the chief character was somebody who had a very significant infirmity. And I thought to myself, I'm not knowing Stegner, and kept thinking about it. I've also read something else like I was very impressed on his Zion trail, I think it was.
Gathering
of Zion. I thought that was marvelous. But I thought, what kind of man is this? Your comment's very interesting, because I thought, these people in these other two books I had read were so grotesque, and yet you're describing this marvelous intellectual real worldly, not worldly, but sort of a great stature of a man. As you see him, I find myself with a little bit of a dichotomy here.
Hmm. I knew him. He was my teacher, and I knew him in that way. And he was a wonderful teacher.
Karen, where would you advise people to start if they don't know Stegner?
Angle of Repose, which this gentleman had a hard time finishing. There's a wonderful collection. There's a collection of the complete short stories. Those short stories are wonderful. Lots of those, that'd be a good place to start.
Is
actually.
That where the Bluebird Sings and the Legend?
No, there's a great big collection. It's called The Collected Short Stories of Wallace Stegner.
I know. I read. I started with Crossing to Safety, and I never wanted it to end. I'd stop in the middle sometimes because I didn't want to finish it. It's just a wonderful book. So I think that Wallace Stegner is certainly an author that would be worthwhile getting acquainted with if you're not. Yes.
Is Crossing to Safety mostly an autobiographical novel, I'm sure, but it doesn't have a lot of...
I've heard people say that. Stegner's wife, of course, does not have the physical handicaps that that the main character's wife had in the novel. There are lots of differences, but I've heard people say too in interviews who knew a lot more than I, that indeed that there were lots of autobiographical parts in that, and his graduate school experiences and such things.
Just read Coffee's Baking on Reading and overheard, and I'm wondering because he seems fascinated with people with physical disabilities. And do you know where that comes from in his life? Do you have a sense of family?
No. He always seemed to me very robust, and his wife and son seemed healthy, and I don't know.
Does anyone else want to make any comments or ask any questions?
Was that the story that you read, was that an experience that you actually had with our team in the Army?
Was your story an experience you actually had, or was that just straight from imagination?
Well, of course, it is true. Many things happened during the war. And there are many oddballs including me.
Couldn't be too bad if you play golf.
Well, let's give our
one more question. Has Karen published anything?
Just mostly things that people would read in the sort of audience that I'm referring to. So that in the kind of fringe Mormon publications, I've published quite
She's
a few
published
stories and things. Mostly dialogue.
Dialogue.
Yeah.
And what's the name of the anthology?
Well, let's see. There's Jean England edited an anthology called Bright Angels, and does anybody know what it's called? I forget. Anyway, he edited an anthology a couple of years ago. Levi Peterson edited one called Greening Wheat. Those are two collections of Mormon fiction. I have a story in each.
What was the book
that
chose your?
He put every 2 years he would put out a collection of short stories from students in the seminars, and they would be called things like Stanford Short Story 64, Stanford Short Story 68, really exciting titles. So.
Okay, well, let's give our authors.